on and welcome. This is an audio conference training of Praxis International for the Rural Grantees of Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for today's call. We're excited about the training that we have scheduled. We are very fortunate to be joined by three trainers on the line for our training on failure to protect. How can we do more for battered women and their children? Today is the first part of this two-part series, and the specific topic is the unintended consequences of failure to protect. I'm joined on the line by my colleague at Praxis, Olga Trujillo. She is a technical assistance partner with us, and she's actually calling from the same location that I am today. She's right next door in my office, so I'm pretty sure you're there, right, Olga?
Yeah, I'm right here, Liz. Thanks.
Yeah, good. Welcome. And we are also joined on the line by Joyce Yadlosky and Catherine Munster. They are members of the West Virginia Coalition, and they are going to talk specifically about their process in work that they have done locally within their state. Joyce and Kathy, you're with us?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome. Before I have the call turned over to Joyce and Kathy and Olga, I want to just remind you all of a couple of basics of how these calls work. We record these sessions and we make them available online for listening to through streaming on our website. So if you would like to go back and refer to this training and at a future date, we encourage you to do so. You will find this session available under the Rural TA portion of our website. I also would like to just let you know that the call will be muted for the duration today, and the operator will assist us with the question and comment session in about a half an hour or so. At that point, our operator, Stephanie, will let you know how to get into the question queue. And if you have a question between now and then, we encourage you just jot it down and save it for a few minutes from now. I don't have any further logistics at this point. So, Olga, if you want to go ahead and further introduce yourself and Kathy and Joyce the same, then we'll just get started with the discussion.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Liz.
Yes.
So I'm Olga Trujillo, and I am a consultant for Praxis International, a technical assistance partner. And around the issue of domestic violence and child protection, I've done a lot of work around the country working with programs to try to figure out how to work better in collaboration between domestic violence programs, child welfare agencies, and sometimes the courts. And I'm also an attorney, and I used to work at the U.S. Department of Justice, where we funded a number of collaborations around this issue. So a lot of the of what I'm going to bring to this call and next week's call is around some of that work. So then, Joyce and Kathy, do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, thank you, Olga. I'm Joyce Yadlosky, and I'm the Protective Services Coordinator with the West Virginia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And I come from a background as a domestic violence advocate, started back in 1988 in South Carolina, where I started working with a local shelter-based domestic violence program in family court, and then also kind of switched over and did a little bit of work as a foster care social worker and was a foster parent. In 1999, I moved back to my home state of West Virginia, where I started coordinating statewide collaboratives addressing the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child victimization. And so I coordinate a statewide work group as well as participate on state and national initiatives having to do with child protection system and domestic violence. And I also do work with the adult protection system and vulnerable adults.
And I'm Catherine Munster. I go by Kathy. And I have been working child welfare for a little over 30 years. I started out doing child protective services for what was then called the Department of Welfare in some of the most rural counties of West Virginia. Did that for several years. Eventually went to law school, and thereafter, for the next 20-plus years, have represented abused and neglected children in proceedings which we call in West Virginia civil child protection, which is known in some states as dependency proceedings, but it's all part of the child protective system. It was in that context that I became very much aware of the need for collaboration and systems change in how we were handling families with violence, where there was both domestic violence and child abuse and neglect. I started working with the Supreme Court, State Supreme Court's Court Improvement Board, which is a collaborative effort here in West Virginia. And in my representation of children and advocating for children and working on court improvement in the child welfare system, I became acquainted with Diane Reese, who was one of the co-directors of the West Virginia Domestic Violence Coalition and a wonderful, wonderful woman, who was also very interested in collaborating, and she worked on the Green Book Project, which is the collaboration of court systems, CPS, and DV. And she was very interested in what was getting started then by the coalition, the Domestic Violence and Child Abuse and Neglect Work Group, and she invited me to join. And there I met Joyce and the Domestic Violence Coalition and have been working independent, of course, of the coalition, but in many joint projects with them.
That's great. You know, it just takes me back for a minute because just to tie how we're connected in terms of West Virginia and Joyce, you know all this, and the work that I've done. When I was at the U.S. Department of Justice, I was one of the original funders of the Green Book Project, and that's when I met Diane Reese.
Oh.
And then also the experience that I bring of having been a survivor in a home where there was domestic violence and I was abused. And have done, have been part of some of West Virginia's conferences, some of the coalition's conferences. So it's actually it's really nice to be on this call with the two of you, and I'm really excited about what we're going to hear that you all have been doing. So let me just kind of give everybody kind of a place to, like a floor to start with. I've been looking at and working with the co-occurrence of violence in homes, whether domestic violence and child abuse, for about 15 years now. And so what we've seen around the country is as domestic violence advocates have made people more and more aware of how serious domestic violence is, and to try to get people, mostly law enforcement and the courts, to be able to have a more concrete response to domestic violence victims, they started to show how children are also being affected as well. And one of the unintended consequences of showing for advocates, domestic violence advocates, to show how children are also being affected is the failure to protect the law under child welfare laws around the country of failure to protect. And a lot of domestic violence cases fall under failure to protect. What we've seen around the country is state by state have enacted laws where it usually would have been a neglect case, but where they can get to the domestic violence victim and try to get the domestic violence victim to do something to protect the child. And that's from the perspective of a lot of child welfare agencies. That failure to protect was a tool that they had to try to make that domestic violence victim get an order for protection or call the police or leave and go to shelter to protect that child. And they felt that they really needed that tool to do that. And what happened is that a lot of domestic violence victims who felt that their level of risk or for some reason or another, you know, first of all the responsibility was put on the domestic violence victim to stop the violence when other systems weren't able to stop the batterer from perpetrating violence. And then the second thing is that domestic violence victims were having to choose between the level of risk that they might have been seeing in their homes if they left and their children. So then a lot of people around the country started to try to work together, domestic violence programs and child welfare agencies and court systems, the dependency court or juvenile court in different locations, started to work together to try to figure out how they can take into account domestic violence when they're dealing with child protection, when a child abuse claim came up, how they could also take into account domestic violence. So what I've seen around the country is a lot of co-training, co-advocacy, a lot of awareness happening about the child welfare system for domestic violence advocates, and then for the child welfare agencies, for them to learn their a lot of the efforts that they made was to learn more about domestic violence, to learn about the resources, and in a lot of cases, co-locate domestic violence advocates within their organizations so that when they thought that they saw someone who was also a victim of domestic violence, that they could have a domestic violence advocate work with them. So, and that's been successful in a lot of locations in terms of kind of minimizing re-victimization of domestic violence victims and their children. But I haven't seen an approach anything like what West Virginia has done. So I'm really excited to have the Kathy and Joyce from West Virginia tell you about what they've done in West Virginia. And just to lay this out, this is one of two calls. So today they're going to talk to you about basically how they got to what they did and then what they did, and if we have time, some of the challenges they faced. And then next week we're going to talk, on October 21st, we're going to talk about the implementation of West Virginia's approach, some of the challenges, and then from a perspective of a survivor, which is where I come in, you know, assessing needs and the impact of trauma. So with that, Kathy and Joyce, are you guys okay to pick up from there?
Sure. This is Kathy. In response to some of what you said, Olga, I think one of the biggest differences that West Virginia has made to the process you describe is that after some collaboration, and Joyce and I are going to talk about the reasons why we went that route here in a moment, but the major change point for us was to decide that we really needed systems change, that it was not simply for us a matter of co-training and co-advocacy, although those things are hugely important, and we're going to talk about that a lot more as we go along. But we also came to recognize that there were significant systemic barriers in the way that were getting in the way of effective work between CPS, the court system, and domestic violence advocates. And so we decided to take a run at it from a systems-wide, statewide basis in order to reduce those barriers to allow further collaboration, such as you're discussing. And one of the things that we did, of course, was first to recognize the need to collaborate, to start there. And Joyce is going to talk more about the leadership role that the coalition took in putting together the statewide collaboration. But from my perspective, I wanted to mention first that it's really important to engender a sense of why do we need to do this with all of the different players. And so I want to speak from the CPS perspective as well as from the court system. Briefly, with respect to the court system, I think in West Virginia, judges and lawyers had a sense that this wasn't working in the civil protection of children arena. There was some real dissatisfaction both at our state Supreme Court level as well as our lower judiciary levels that this wasn't working, and that was one of the reasons why the Court Improvement Board became seriously interested, actually was created, to take a look at how to improve our results in child protection.
So Kathy, can I just jump in for a second?
Sure.
You have a Court Improvement Board, and so that was something separate and apart from what the coalition was already working on, right?
Absolutely. Good point. And the thing that needs to be mentioned here somewhere is that every state, with the possible exception of one or two, has such a Court Improvement Board because it's a federal grant program and it's a non-competitive grant. And so virtually all the states' Supreme Courts are receiving money for the purpose of improving their court system with respect to child abuse and neglect. And, of course, eventually where this all leads is that we grew to include domestic violence, coalition members, and Joyce will get into more of that. But the court system has a huge incentive to collaborate because they not only care as individuals, they don't, as judges, there's no desire to see people hurt, quite the contrary. And there's also federal money that promotes that kind of collaboration. There's also something called the Federal Review, which takes place in court systems as well as the DHHR, and that insists on collaboration. So there's a lot of federal reasons that incentivizes collaboration on a statewide level. From a child protection point of view, those same kinds of things exist. There's a federal audit that requires collaboration and better work with the court systems and in domestic violence. There is, however, I think something even stronger, and that is that people who work in the child welfare system have a lifeboat, if I may say, mentality. In other words, nobody's in this work for the money. They're in it because they care deeply about the results for children. And part of the education process that happens as a result of outreach efforts, but also comes just from the experience of doing CPS, in my experience, is the knowledge that you don't want to leave anybody behind, and that if there's another victim in that house, you don't want to leave them alone out there on a sinking Titanic while you're rowing off in your lifeboat. And there's been a general dissatisfaction with that result, but not knowing what to do about it because of the constraints of the system. Also, of course, there's this huge co-occurrence rate as more and more child protective workers become aware and as more systems folks in the DHHR become aware, the single leading precursor to child fatality is domestic violence. So if you really care about what happens to children, you have to care about what's happening in the domestic violence arena. So those are some of the reasons that brought us all to the table.
Yes, and I'll pick up from there in talking about a little, I have to talk about, this is Joyce, and I have to talk about some of the collaborative efforts that got us to where we will get into the nuts and bolts of some of what we did, because I don't think that it could have happened without really good collaboration. And part of what I said that I coordinate is a statewide work group that is a collaborative work group that specifically looks on the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child victimization, and it has all the system players. It has the court representatives and DHHR, the CPS, and domestic violence advocates, as well as battery intervention, child advocates, all of the different players. But it's not just this particular work group that collaborated. I mean, we specifically educated ourselves. We brought in national trainers. We cross-trained. We really got to understand each other's issues. Many of us confessed that we came to the table so that we could tell others what we wanted them to know and found out that we had a lot to learn ourselves. And but beyond that, we also found the need to collaborate in other areas, such as the Court Improvement Project that Kathy was talking about. We have a seat on that project so that we're involved there. And we actually, anything that we, in our state that has to do with child abuse and neglect, there's a domestic violence representative there pretty much. Anything having to do with domestic violence, there's pretty much a child abuse and neglect representative there. So we cross cross-pollinate each other's collaboratives all around the state because we have, see a need to do that. And so just some key places that we did that. The Court Improvement Board is really key. We also have a citizen review panel that operates on a statewide level. Many states have them. Some operate locally. Some operate on a statewide level. And then the Child Family Services Review, as Kathy talked about, came about right at the same time that we were having some understanding that we needed to make some changes. So those were some key places where when we started recognizing a need for systemic change, we were able to utilize those collaboratives to make the change work statewide. And I want to just take a moment to talk about how I as a DV advocate came to recognize a huge barrier in our system that specifically addressed failure to protect. And it was actually at one of the Green Book regional meetings. We had our little team that many people had, our court representative, myself, and the CPS representative there, and our judge that was there, Judge Johnson, was really good. He really seemed to get the issue really well. And we were having a discussion, and they were talking about failure to protect, and he said, yes, failure to protect, we have to use this. The only way we can get these cases into court. And I thought, you know, here I thought this judge got it, and I'm going to have to do more education with this judge. He doesn't get it. And it was me who didn't get it. What he was trying to say and what I learned as I learned more about policy was that even though many of the CPS workers were like Kathy was just talking about, they didn't want to leave the battered woman on the sinking Titanic while they rode away with the children. They had no other way of doing it because the system didn't allow them another process. Our system is set up, as many states are, that both parents are either at fault for abusing or neglecting, or they're not involved in the process. And that's how our state was as well. So when you had parents, they were always seen as at fault. And when you had a battered parent and there was nothing directly necessary that they had done to abuse and neglect the children, then they became at fault for failing to protect. And many workers had talked about that was the only thing that they could do to get the case into court. And we started looking at our court system, and there weren't any other options other than to find the parent at fault. So we started looking at what can we do in our system to make some change. And we saw that we needed a huge systemic change. And I'm going to let Kathy go into the nuts and bolts of how we looked at our policy, looked at our court rules, we looked at legislative change. And through a package deal, we made several changes to help break down this barrier.
This is Kathy again. I can't emphasize enough the importance of one of many things that Joyce just said, because I think that this is true probably around the country. Certainly it was true in West Virginia. And that was both the policy and the attitude of the Department of Health and Human Resources, that if you have one protecting parent, then the DHHR has no role in the case. They just walk away because you've got a protecting parent. However, if their DHHR is going to be involved, then both parents have to be at fault. And that was an essential premise of how the legal system worked, of DHHR policy. And what it led to was this failure to protect adage, that this label that would get put on a parent who was not protecting but was not abusing, but how do you get them into court? How do you open a case if you got one protecting parent, you can't open a case? So both of them have to be guilty of something, and so you'd label them with this failure to protect. This was, after all this collaboration and conversation and talk, we realized was one of our really core issues and that we needed to change, because even with well-intentioned workers and well-intentioned judges and wonderful DV advocates, this was a systemic block to further collaboration in cases, because how in the world could a battered parent work cooperatively with the DHHR faced with fear of losing the children? Because there was one choice. You either went it alone, you went down and got a protective order all by yourself with no lawyer and no help, or you got labeled abusing or neglecting because you failed to protect. I mean, what a devil's choice. This was an impossible situation. We were losing children. We were losing moms. We were losing victims. this was not a sustainable system, and yet this was what everybody knew. So what did we do? In terms of systems change, I believe you have some materials, and one of them, it will be a sheet that says systemic change at the top, systemic change for a safer state of family, and that lays out in summary some of the concepts that I want to just touch on right now. One of the most important things, and probably the first and most important thing, is that West Virginia did away with the title Failure to Protect in 1988. Our state Supreme Court has always been very, very concerned about the plight of both children and battered women. And in the case of Betty J.W., specifically held as a matter of law that when you review the statutes on child welfare, nowhere do you find this term, failure to protect. What you find is the term knowingly allow a third person to harm the child. And West Virginia held in that case of Betty J.W. that no one knowingly allows anything with a knife at her throat. And so was the kernel of the change that we grew through the last couple of years in terms of the serious systems change across the board. Because what the state Supreme Court said was that knowingly allow means taking no reasonable steps under circumstances given the nature of the threat of harm to the adult. Not what is the threat of harm to the child, but what are reasonable steps taken to protect given the nature of the threat to the adult. So that became our new knowingly allow doctrine. The problem is nobody was reading this case. Judges weren't reading it. CPS never heard of it. So we realized we had to make some other changes. And let me just go through briefly what we did. First of all of DHHR policy as a result of this collaboration has been completely rewritten, and failure to protect has been eradicated in its entirety in every form in its manual. And believe me, those of you who may have worked with CPS know how important the manuals and the policies are. So if you change the policy, that's a good start. Now the DHHR policy accurately reflects the law of the Betty J.W. decision of our state Supreme Court. We also created a new policy for the DHHR in which they recognized that they had a non-delegatable duty to protect children. In other words, you can't say, I'm going to meet my duty to protect children by telling somebody else to do it for me. So they could not tell a protecting parent, you go protect the child, and we got nothing more to do with you, because they could not delegate to a third party their duty to protect. Instead, policy has been rewritten so that if you have a parent who wants to protect, maybe having some trouble doing it, needs some help, the duty of the DHHR is to stand shoulder to shoulder with that parent, empowering that parent to protect and to help protect instead of walking away. To further this principle, we rewrote the Supreme Court rules that apply to all our child abuse cases, to say that a protecting parent can now co-petition with the DHHR to hold the batterer accountable. This allows a battered parent who has a child who is they're trying to protect to co-petition against the batterer or the abuser together and not be a respondent at all, so you don't have this problem at all of having to be found at fault anymore. You can be a co-petitioner with the department and bring the case together. This is, now I'm still talking about civil child protection proceedings, not custody cases, okay? If we need to, we'll talk about custody cases in a different context, but right now we're talking about child protection and the removal cases that Olga referred to earlier. If a co-petition is brought, there's no need to remove the child from the parent, the abused parent, because they're not at fault. So custody can remain with the battered parent, and the Department of Human Services can continue to provide services and do those kinds of things, but there can be a restraining order that's brought against the batterer, and most importantly, in many cases, the rights of the batterer can be terminated, which cannot be done in any other context in West Virginia. But just because the rights are terminated doesn't mean that parent has to do without child support, because in West Virginia, rights can be terminated and child support obligation continue, even if it has to be funneled through the DHHR so that the location of the battered parent and child is not known to the batterer. Another concept that we involved was something called the battered parent adjudication. We realized with hearing from advocates and survivors that some parents are not going to be able to co-petition. It's not safe, or for a variety of other reasons. So we now have in West Virginia what is called the battered parent adjudication, where a parent who has not participated in or knowingly allowed the abuse, and remember what our test of knowingly allow is in West Virginia, given the nature of the threat, but who cannot co-petition, can be adjudicated a battered parent, not abusing, not neglecting, so you don't have that stigma, but simply adjudicated battered. And they can then continue to get services, they can work with the department, and it greatly restricts, actually entirely restricts, to only one circumstance in which that parent's rights can be terminated, and that is if they are unwilling or unable to participate in any kind of a program which would help them parent effectively. So the battered parent adjudication is another huge step forward, we thought, another safe haven that we could provide even for folks who were not yet in a position where they could co-petition. We also changed our law to allow, under the reunification statute, the feds require our efforts at reunification. We now in West Virginia have changed that, modified it to say that reunification goal is met if the child can be reunified with any portion of the family. So the DHHR is no longer feeling constrained to reunify the whole family if one of the parents is a batterer. So they can meet the federal guidelines by reuniting with a battered victim. We've also changed our mandatory petition statute so that if a batterer murders the other parent or maliciously wounds the other parent, there's a list of different things like that, then that becomes a mandatory petition by the department. They have to intervene in that case in the name of the child, but if the other victim has not been killed, that person could also join as a co-petitioner.
Hey, Kathy. This is Olga. Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
When you're saying that that they can petition, does that mean essentially that the batterer has to leave the home?
They very well might. One of the things that our rules now provide for is a restraining order to put the batterer out. So part of the training that we do with this is to help CPS evaluate a co-petition and receiving an order from the from our court that doesn't remove the parent and the child from the home, but removes the batterer from the home.
Okay.
And let me add to that. I'm not sure if this is where you're going with this, Olga, but also in our state, our court cases are only a small percentage of cases that rise to the level. Typically, before co-petitioning, court cases were only cases where there were removal or if there was non-cooperation. And other cases that the department was involved in were considered voluntary cases. And I understand that many states are structured so that any CPS involvement is in court, and in our state it is not. So in those cases where families might all still be together living with a batterer, those cases would not be co-petitioning type cases because they wouldn't be in court. Only the cases where they felt that the safety of the child rose to the level where they would not be able to live with the batterer, where they where it was coming close to what previously might have needed to have been a removal, would that case be in court.
Okay, great.
And one other thing I need to add is that we had, in some jurisdictions in our state, judges who refused to recognize domestic violence as being grounds for a child abuse and neglect petition at all, ever, under any circumstances. So one of the modifications to the statute that we made, and that's why it all has to be done as a piece, you can't all in one big go, you can't do it piecemeal, We also added domestic violence to the times when it could rise to child abuse for purposes of these petitions, which has been the law actually in West Virginia from the court's perspective for some time, but some of our judges were a little hard-headed. But it has to rise to the level of harm. In other words, not all domestic violence is going to be a child abuse and neglect matter. We were very careful not to make that mistake. It has to rise to a certain level of harm. And again, in your materials, I think you'll find some handouts that talk about, that come from the trainings that we do to help social workers deal with making that decision, that assessment as to when does domestic violence rise to the level necessary to warrant state intervention.
So that's the handout that's titled Child Abuse Neglect Petitions in Circuit Court, Considerations for Filing a Child Abuse Neglect Petition?
Those are considerations for filing a petition that gets our cases in West Virginia in court. The other handout that says when does harm to a child rise to the level of child abuse and neglect addresses even milder versions of domestic violence, so that when does it rise to the level to make a mandatory report, when does it rise to the level for opening a case and then for filing a petition.
That's great. Okay.
Because as Joyce said earlier, about 80% or so of West Virginia's child protection cases are not in the court system.
Right.
So it's basically providing services, safety planning, working with families cooperatively. They, in general, in West Virginia, courts become involved only when, as Joyce said, circumstances are so unsafe that a child would otherwise have to be removed. Now they can co-petition, but in other words, you've got to separate the child from the abuser, or when nobody's willing to cooperate with the department in order to assure safety.
Okay. So, Kathy, I jumped in and asked you a couple questions. I'm not sure if you finished this section.
Yeah, I think I have.
Okay. And Joyce, did you want to add anything to this point so far?
Just one more little thing, and that is to what Kathy said, about 80% of our cases are considered voluntary changes, or cases. And when we made this systemic change for how court was proceeded, we also believe that that has helped an attitudinal change in how the department works with the voluntary cases as well, because the policy changes certainly apply there, but also the implications of having to legally find someone at fault in court cases carries over into the voluntary cases of constantly working with someone from the perspective that they are at fault. And so by changing that process in court, we're hoping that that's going to follow through and make changes in the voluntary cases as well.
That's a really good point, because if the social workers that are working with the families have one perspective, that this mother who is a victim is it's not seeing her as a victim, but seeing her as someone who's not protecting this child in a voluntary case, how does that shift then when it becomes a case that goes to court? Like, how do you shift that thinking?
Exactly. And actually, what you just said about is something that one of the workers said to me. I was doing a training, and one of the workers was telling me about their new policy, and this is how the worker put it. We have policy now that says we have to treat the adult like victims, too, when there's domestic violence. And so in that sense, it was shifting from treating them as someone who's at fault to someone who needs help, who needs protection.
And that is a very, very real part of, and we'll talk later when we talk about implementation, the massive statewide trainings that we have done. We set as a goal, just as a hint for future reference, that in 6 months we were going to train every judge, every magistrate, every CPS worker, across the board, everybody in the state, and then we're all going to get the same training, so we're all singing from the same hymnal. So there's been a massive investment of effort in not only changing the policies and the laws and the rules, but also in terms of getting everybody on the same page in how we now do all of this.
Wow.
Because one of the things, as Joyce was alluding to, we all now have to treat victims as victims, whether they're adult or children, is part of that training process is how to do safety planning with adults. I mean, how do you make sure nobody's on the Titanic?
Right. Okay, so is this a good time to stop and take questions, you guys?
Yeah.
Okay. So Liz, are you there?
I am.
So let's see if we have any questions or comments, and then we'll see how many we have, and see if we can get the challenges.
At this time, if you do have a question or comment, please press the number one. Please be sure to press the number one only once. If you press it more than once, you will remove yourself from the questioning queue. And just one moment while we see if you have any callers.
Okay. Thanks, Stephanie.
Okay. We do have a question from our guest in Medford, Oregon. Your line is open.
I was just wondering, you had mentioned about restraining orders. I was wondering if those restraining orders are, like, the violations of those orders are enforced criminally.
Yes. One of the real advantages in West Virginia to bringing these processes through the child protection system rather than the old custody system is that in West Virginia, our judges in child protection cases, we call them circuit judges, have more power than our family court judges, and the circuit judge can hold a perpetrator in criminal contempt of a restraining order. They do have powers of criminal contempt.
And the other difference in these kind of orders, too, is not only do they say that the batter has to stay away, but if the batter has an interest in seeing or continuing to have rights with his children, this restraining order is part of the child abuse and neglect improvement period process. And if they violate any part of that process, they immediately move to termination of parental rights. So there's that incentive not just to stay away because it's harmful, which should be enough, but often isn't, but it also can prevent you from having rights to your children. It's connected with that.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, these are, and make sure that we're being clear about the distinction, this is not a domestic violence protective order, which you may be more familiar with. These are being brought through in West Virginia, a different court system, which deals with the child protection system. And so these judges have the power in West Virginia, not only for criminal contempt, but also, as Joyce pointed out, to terminate parental rights and to find any violation of an improvement period where they may be having visitation or whatever, to be grounds for ending the relationship.
You know, Kathy, this is Olga. What I find, and I'm curious, and I don't mean to put you on the spot because I know you're mostly focused on West Virginia law, but what I find is almost every state has a child order of protection that somewhere either child welfare or the dependency courts, someone in that system can file a child order of protection that they could submit to keep the batterer away from that child, and that most judges, once that's filed, most dependency court judges or juvenile court judges have the ability to hold someone in contempt of court if they violate it. That's what I've seen in many states, but most people don't know about it, and hardly any judges have, in any of the states that I've worked with, have ever invoked it. Is that your understanding as well, or is what you've done in West Virginia even further along than that?
Well, we also have the Domestic Violence Protective Order that can be used to protect children, and we do use that process. The batters can be held in contempt. We're not saying they can't be held in contempt. It just can't happen in our family court. It has to happen in a magistrate court.
Right.
Courts have limited jurisdiction, but it can happen. But the problems with that is, first of all, it's limited terms, and there's no review hearing to see whether or not the batterer has violated that protective order in any way. So the benefit of having it in a child abuse and neglect proceeding,
right,
in addition to the contempt power and the criminal contempt power, is the fact that there's going to be a review hearing, and it's connected to them being able to see their children. And so somebody's eye is going to be on it. It's a sterner order. It's a bigger order and seems to be much more effective. Most batterers, when they're in a child abuse and neglect proceeding, don't violate the orders as easily they do in a typical protective order proceeding.
That's good.
And judges hold them to it.
That's great. That's fabulous.
Any other questions or comments? Stephanie, do we have other folks on the queue?
Yes, we do have our guest from Denver, Colorado. Your line is open.
Yes, I was just curious about the 80% of cases in West Virginia being voluntary, and I'm wondering if that's related to the non-delegatable duty of child protective workers. Does that sort of then, do those voluntary cases somewhat replace the general process of going through a civil custody filing?
This kind of, my awareness of the answer to that question is pretty legal. Many other states have all of their cases in court because a court has found that constitutionally it's not truly cooperation if CPS is involved. It's always coercive to some degree, and so they don't allow state intervention without court approval. West Virginia has simply not gone down that road, and I'm very grateful for that because, frankly, I think that much more cooperative work can happen outside of the court system. Once it gets into the court system, it can become pretty traditionally pretty confrontational, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to kind of realign the parties here and not have it confrontational between CPS and a battered parent. We wanted to set it up in such a way that they could be partners in this proceeding rather than adversaries. That can be hard to do in the court system, but that was one of the main impetuses of the changes that we made, was to allow that partnership rather than the adversarialness of it. So to answer your question, I think that the 80% out of the court system has been the case in West Virginia long before these reforms, and probably was not much related to the non-delegatable duty.
And if I can jump in too, not specifically on West Virginia, I've seen this across the country, that there are mechanisms that other states use that are quote-unquote voluntary, like when they're investigating and they haven't found they haven't substantiated a case, that's considered still involuntary. Still considered to be, the person following the case plan would still be considered a voluntary case plan. They don't have to do it because they're not being ordered by the court to do it. But the person who has the case plan may not feel that it's a voluntary situation because the potential, if they don't fill these things, the potential that it could go to court hangs over their head. And that's what I've seen in a lot of courts. Is that similar to what happens in West Virginia, or is that different?
No, that's very similar, I think. This is Kathy again. I think that voluntary is almost tongue-in-cheek. It certainly doesn't feel voluntary on the other end, I think, for many folks. And so part of this effort, as Joyce has already said, is not only to change the attitude within the court system to allow empowerment and partnering, but to make sure that that same change in policy and approach is in all of the other 80% of the cases as well.
And
because to be directly responsive to what you said, Olga, I don't think a caseworker can shift mid-case just because it's going to court, suddenly have a different attitude. I think we're talking about changing a culture, changing attitudes at every step of the proceeding, including intake.
And that's to me the difference that you all have in West Virginia, is that you have the law, you have case law, you have policies and procedures that support that shift. And now you're going to have the training, all the implementation pieces, but where in other places it's that people want to work that way, the people that want to, like, seek it out, the people who don't, you know, don't end up working that way.
And so the way you're treated ends up being a function of what county you live in.
Right, or who the insight and the education of the person that you're working with.
Yeah.
Okay, other comments or questions?
At this time, there are no additional questions.
Okay, great. So we have enough time to go into challenges then. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Great. Okay, so all right. In the process, and you've kind of alluded to a few of these, but so what challenges have you started to see
in making these types of changes?
Well, if I might, Olga, not just in terms of implementation, but I think in terms of the challenges that we face just getting as far as we have, because like we started out saying, we concluded that systems change was really, really important in order to enable everybody to get on the right page. But it took us some time to get to the place of what systems changes were we going to make. I mean, I can tell you in 20 minutes or less all about co-petitioning and battered parent adjudication and those kinds of changes, but I can tell you it took us some time to get to those places. And so if other folks are interested in taking a look at maybe doing something similar in their area, it's, I think, important to talk a little bit about the challenges that we face just getting that far, much less the challenges of implementation.
Yeah, no, you're right, Kathy. Actually, we're supposed to talk about the challenges of how you got to where you are, and next week talk about the challenges of implementation.
Yeah, okay.
You're absolutely right.
Okie doke. So maybe Joyce could start with the challenges I know that the coalition faced, though.
One of the first challenges, I think, was getting everybody on the same page and providing, making sure that we were talking about the same things, and we were not. When we first met, we started talking. We all thought, sometimes we thought we were in agreement. Actually, we were talking about apples and oranges most of the time. We had to define, redefine, and then define again almost everything that we were talking about in terms of our terminology, and that was key. One of the key pieces that we really had to define even was, what is domestic violence? And that is a huge discussion that's even happening right now. That was critical when it came to talking about, when does domestic violence rise to the level of child abuse? Because are we just talking about a legal definition where two people cause harm regardless of the context, or are we talking about this whole pattern of power and control? So we had to go through and make some of those definitions, distinctions, and actually that is still a challenge. We're still working on that. But we did meet that challenge by coming to some agreement about that within our work group, but to do that, we didn't just talk about it. We brought in, we put some money into this, and I don't want to say a lot of money, I don't want to discourage anyone who doesn't have a lot of money, but we had a grant that allowed us to bring people together, give them some lunch, pay them some mileage, and bring in some national trainers from all the different areas. We had judicial trainers, CPS trainers, CV advocate trainers, we had Susan Schechter, Jeff Edelson, Olga, and all these people come in to help educate the key players so that we could understand what we were talking about. And when people, and I know you all have found this too, once people understand the issues, then they easily come on board. And so that was a big challenge, getting people to understand the issues. And then once we understood particularly the definition of domestic violence, another policy change was to define domestic violence as being that something that is in the context of power and control, and separating out power and control dynamics from other forms of violence that might occur, so that we didn't have this big net of capturing everybody into the child abuse and neglect system, and helping understand what some of the issues were, in addition to understanding the policy changes as well.
I think some of the challenges too, were very, very basic, and it may seem oversimplistic, but we just didn't understand what each other did. I mean, we thought we understood. I knew what DV advocates did and what battering was about. And so it wasn't just, as Joyce was saying, a matter of bringing everybody together and having conversations and national speakers. It really was, as Joyce was stressing, that we talked to one another for a long time about what we actually did and what brought us to this work. There is so much mutual suspicion and misunderstanding between the disciplines of helpers that it took us a while to get to know one another and actually sit down and say, what is it that a CPS worker does? Let's walk a day in the life of a CPS worker and a day in the life of a DV advocate, and really starting to understand what we actually did and get over blaming one another. You know, there's just such a history of, well, child protection doesn't care about battered women, and you know, this feeling of enmity, CPS falling back on failure to protect. I can tell you one of the places I remember it becoming really, really bringing it to the fore was talking about, is domestic violence always child abuse? And here we'd all been getting along better for about a year or 6 months or so, and Joyce threw that topic down on the table.
Wow.
And boy, all bets were off. I mean, everybody came out of their corner. And it was a fascinating conversation because the feelings run very high on these issues. And so we really ended up having to do a lot of basic groundwork, coming to the conclusion that nobody is in this work for the money, that all of us care deeply about what we do and that there is value to what we do. As a matter of fact, we developed some training on basic public policy principles. What are the basic public policy principles that are essential to a DV advocate? What are those principles that are essential to child protection? What are those principles that are essential to the legal system? And coming to the conclusion that none of us would want those principles relinquished. I mean, these principles are important to all of us that we hold. So how can we do our work in ways that do not damage one another's principles? And so changing the dialogue from "you don't care about" to "I know you care deeply about, so what can we do to work together that doesn't do violence to one another's principles, that allows us to go forward intact with respect for one another?" Because until those kinds of things we found happened, we were talking past one another. We were doing a lot of talking, not a lot of listening. So one of the real challenges was to deepen the dialogue in such a way that it became meaningful to all of us, so that we could start really then, for the first time, brainstorming some solutions that were outside of the box, that were not the traditional answers that we'd all been programmed to give, but to find, say, this isn't good enough. Let me give you an example. We do an exercise on what is the effect of domestic violence on children. And you know, boy, CPS, they just love that exercise. They can just start at the top of the page, you know, golly, what it does. That's assuming they want domestic violence on their caseload at all. We also had a contingent that didn't want to deal with it. But, you know, you get folks into it, and they start talking about, well, kids can get hurt too, or the emotional damage, and you go through all of that. And that pretty soon they filled out a page or several blackboards. And then you ask the question, okay, now what is the effect on the child of removal from the home?
Wow.
And there's generally this sort of silence on the CPS side. And all of a sudden the DV advocates get real active. And they start filling a whole nother side of the page, a whole nother blackboard with their list. What is the effect on the child of removal? And then it becomes very obvious to everyone in the room that the two lists look the same. And that's when we get to the place where we can start talking about, if this is the only alternative that we have for children, a choice between these two lists, then what have we done? What have we really offered them? We need to be better than that. We need to find a third way of going. We need to work together to find something different. And then I think that's the beginnings of starting to do the kind of brainstorming that led to some of the solutions that we came up with together, which had mutual buy-in, because there's no way you can go to a court and ask for rules changes. There's no way you can go to a legislature and ask for this kind of change in legislation unless you've got all of the players on the same page.
A couple other challenges and that we had a little bit of help of timing with. One was with CPS policy, the other was courts. And I'm going to start with CPS policy. We recognize the need to change CPS policy, and that many workers were driven by the policy, and that was one of the things we found out is what drives workers, and many times it was the policy. So if we can get at that policy, how can we make some changes there? And that was easier for me than what I thought it was. The first key for that was to educate the policymakers, and the work group had a representative from the state policy division there all of the time, and it almost feels like that section of the department has institutionalized an understanding of domestic violence now, because we've been through three different staff people there, and sometimes I would worry, okay, we got a new person, we got to start all over again. We really didn't have to. Each new person that came in there already had the training, had the information, and they seemed to get it. What was helpful, though, is our child family services review came about right at the same time. And it, like many states, said that in West Virginia, we weren't doing a very good job at recognizing domestic violence and helping families with it once we recognized it. And so it had to be part of their program improvement plan to work with domestic violence. Well, we already had this collaborative going, so they brought us into the table. We got mandated domestic violence. We got a contract to mandate domestic violence training for all child welfare workers. Our coalition, in collaboration with the department, writes the curriculum and facilitates the training on that. And then we found out in doing the training that the training that was recommended didn't match the policy, so we needed to change the policy. And we were offered to come in and help write the policy, and we matched that up with what the case law said, because Kathy was on the collaborative and knew that and was able to tell that to us. Also at the same time, the review involved the court improvement project. And so they got in on the program improvement plan as well. And that kind of leads to the challenge of the court. It was really hard at first to even get judges to participate in the work group. Prior to my developing our work group, we actually just had a training on full faith and credit that we wanted judges to come to. Many of them said they couldn't even come to the training because it was a conflict of interest for them. And that was one of the places that Kathy came to help us as well. So we had the Supreme Court help the judges know that it was okay for them to come to that training, that they could participate in that way. And we brought in Judge Fitzgerald to talk about the ethics of judges being able to participate in collaborations and still remain unbiased on the bench. And so once we got through that, we got some good judges. The Supreme Court helped us appoint some judges to our work group. And then when we got on the Court Improvement Board, we had access to judges there as well, and started flowing into making some other changes that we had to make between our family and circuit courts, and that really brought the judges on board. It also brought in help with our Supreme Court to sanction, approve, give their blessing to all of these changes that we just talked about.
I think what Joyce is saying emphasizes the challenge of bringing the necessary people to the table, not just cross-disciplinary, but also at all the different levels of the organization. For instance, with the DHHR, it's really important to have the policy people there. It's also really important, as Joyce had, caseworkers, people who actually did the work in the field to get their perspective. So you had vertical, as I think of an organizational chart, folks from every level, as well as across the board different kinds of disciplines. And the question then becomes, when you're talking about statewide systems change, how do you get the commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Resources to the table?
Right.
The commissioner thinks there's lots more important things that the commissioner ought to be doing. How do you get the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court in your corner? I mean, and these are very important folks to have on your side when it comes time to say, this is the way it's going to be. And so part of our challenge was to get those people to the table on a state systemic basis. And that's where utilizing the strong arm of the feds can be helpful. As Joyce was saying, the main reason I think that the commissioner for the DHHR got interested in some of this was because West Virginia, like every other state, failed the child review, that child welfare review that is conducted by the feds, and was cited, as Joyce said, for this not collaborating with domestic violence, not having a good, strong domestic violence program. Well, that really took it out of the area of argument for the DHHR. This was no longer a question of, well, is it a good idea to make domestic violence part of our purview? They had to. If they were going to continue to get Title IV-E and Title IV-D, which are federal monies for the child welfare system.
So, Kathy, let me just ask, because there's got to be something that was different about your director if so many other states were failing as well, and not very many. I mean, you're the only state that I know of that's done this.
Yeah, and you know what I think happens? I really appreciate you asking that question, Olga. I think this goes to a couple of things. First of all, we already had, but the Court Improvement Board historically had always been collaborative in West Virginia, and Joyce and the coalition were already doing their collaborative in the work group. So we already had in place a collaborative structure. So when the opportunity came along, we were there poised, ready and waiting. The other piece is that both of the collaboratives were dedicated to the notion of bringing not just the top policymakers to the table. In other words, what can happen, and I think has happened in some other states, is you can get the commissioner and the court system, some of the higher-ups together, and they can have lunch and put on paper a certain solution, but it's not true systems change. And I think one of the things that happened in West Virginia was that you had this vertical involvement that I'm talking about, where you had people at every level of the process at the table. So we could all work together to keep each other honest. It wasn't just the commissioner. It was essential that the commissioner be part of this at different stages. But we also had workers from the DHHR. So when the commissioner would say, or a mid-level supervisor would say, well, this is all well and good, but our DHHR workers are never going to want to have domestic violence clients on their caseload, there were people there who could say, that's not true. We think there's a lot of them who would be glad to not leave some people on the Titanic. And, of course, that was borne out eventually in many ways once this all got passed. So I think it's really important when you start looking at this challenge to look at who's at the table. And next time when we get together in the implementation phase, we'll talk to you about some of our failures in that respect, some of the people that we needed at the table that it turns out we didn't have, and what problems that produces for us to this day. But the more people that you can get at the table who represent both the top and the bottom of the process, as well as cross-disciplinary, the better. And one of the ways of getting the top people there is money. I'll just be, straight up about it. The feds have grant programs that require collaboration. And so that can be your friend. You can say to your state Supreme Court administrative office and all of your states out there, who's on the Court Improvement Board? Because the state Supreme Courts have to administer the Court Improvement Board funds and become a part of that. Turn it into a collaborative. Find out a way of how do you get on that to bring DV to the table. That's helped by federal funding now, because now the DHHR and the Court Improvement Projects are both required by their respective overseers in the feds to cooperate with one another. If your local DHHR is also required to cooperate in order to effectuate effective domestic violence programming, then that brings DV to the same table. And so all of a sudden, you've got all three ingredients for the, similar to the Green Book Project, that through the federal programs are required to cooperate with one another. So that's one way of incentivizing getting the top folks there. What you really need to do, though, in addition to that, is to make sure that it's not only the top folks there, that the folks who do the work, the DV advocates who do the work, the CPS workers who do the work, and if I may put in a plug for child advocate attorneys, I think it's also really, really important that people like me can be there, because as a child advocate attorney, in other words, in West Virginia, as in most states, in child abuse and neglect cases, there has to be a guardian ad litem or an attorney appointed to represent the child. Those are folks that do not answer to anybody else. They do not answer to the CPS system. They do not answer to DV advocates. We are independent. And so we can be a bridge sometimes between those systems, because we don't have any investment in the outcome other than advocacy for decreasing family violence. And so bringing more child advocates than just the CPS system, I think, is really, really important. CPS has child protection as an agenda, but it also has preservation of the DHHR as its agenda. I mean, these are bureaucracies. It's helpful to have people who are not embedded in the bureaucracy as part of the folks that are at the table.
Well, and also one of the things that I found around the country is that a lot of judges, when these cases do come before them, really pay attention to what the guardian ad litem, what the attorney for the child has to say when they're weighing all those things. So if they're going to have a big impact on what's going to happen in court, they should be at the table.
No question about it. And one of the things that I think you'll find initially, I'd be surprised if you didn't, in many areas, certainly a problem we had in West Virginia, was that because lawyers were not receiving any training in child abuse or domestic violence in law school or anywhere else, they didn't know what to do. And so very often they just do whatever it was CPS said was a good idea, because they were supposed to be the experts, and really didn't know how to do an independent investigation or to talk to domestic violence advocates or to do any of that. So part of our challenge has been to get this training out to the legal representatives, to get it out to attorneys so that they can become an independent voice speaking for families in, as well as the children. Defense counsel, in other words, not parents' attorneys, not just child attorneys. And so one of the big pieces of this reform effort that we've made here in West Virginia has been cross-the-board training. Joyce has talked about the training with DV and the DHHR, but the Court Improvement Board project took on the cross-training of everybody else, judges, lawyers, DV advocates, CPS, and we do it all in the context of one training. So it's a cross-disciplinary training. And in that, talk about, historically what we've talked about is how do you do child abuse and neglect so that people know what the terms are and how it works and what the considerations are, but also the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child abuse and what the power and control wheel is, so that we're treating, so everybody gets this picture of what family violence looks like, and enabling, we hope, all of the players then to be better advocates. That's taken off wildly in West Virginia. We now, at one point, I think last year, virtually all of the cases that were decided by the state Supreme Court were brought by counsel for children, not the DHHR, but by counsel for children, and in real legitimate advocacy for children in ways that we had not seen in the state before. And that has turned out to be a really important thing in domestic violence cases, because we now see more cases that have been brought with respect to domestic violence and what that can mean in terms of protecting the victim. All of those things now have far greater voice.
So let me see according to my watch, we have about 10 minutes. Is that what you guys have?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wonder if we can check to see, Stephanie, if we have any questions or comments.
At this time, if you do have a question or comment, please press the number one on your phone, and be sure to press the number one only once. And we do have a question from our guest, once again, in Eugene, Oregon. Your line is open.
I'm just curious how this has impacted number of removals in West Virginia, and also how many parental rights have been terminated for the batterer. That's kind
of have you guys gotten that far along? So you know.
Actually, where we are right now in terms of trying to keep statistics is to start looking, and we're very new with this, so we don't have a lot. We're looking at co-petitions, whether or not they're actually being filed. That was one of our very first concerns, was are people using this co-petitioning, and what problems do we have with implementation of that? I am not aware of anybody in West Virginia at this point keeping track of statistics as to the grounds for terminating parental rights, such as battering. We do keep track, of course, of terminating parental rights, and there has certainly been an upswing over the last, since the Court Improvement Board has been working on this, in terms of holding batterers accountable in that way, but not based simply on domestic violence. In other words, I don't know that there's a breakout of why their rights are being terminated.
And actually that kind of leads to one of the challenges, and that is assessing the effectiveness of this change. We did a really good job at making the systemic change we intended to make, and we were able to assess that we did what we had intended to do with the systemic change. In other words, we said we were going to change the policy, we did that. We changed the rules, we trained all of the people, we got the systemic change, made it happen. Now we're at the level, now that we've done that, is the intended effect that we had hoped for there? In other words, are we helping battered women and their children? And that's where we're at now, is trying to make that assessment. And part of that is through statistics. We want to try to, if we can, gather statistics on how many co-petitions are being filed, how many battered parent adjudications are being filed. But the kind of Supreme Court is up to keeping those statistics for us. What we're hoping to do at our coalition is to do, and we're not, our coalition, we don't have a lot of funding to do extensive research. So the best that we're going to be able to do at this point is to do some surveys with families and to try to talk with individual providers and family members who have gone through this system, to talk with them about the effect that it has had on their family and trying to look at how it's helping individual families.
Cool. And you know, the thing that kind of comes to mind when Joyce, you and I have talked about this, it seems to me that this is set up so that the child welfare system is dealing with the cases that the toughest cases, the cases that they really should be dealing with, and that they would be able to have the resources to be able to handle those cases more effectively.
Right.
So instead of bringing a whole bunch of people into the system, this would help them to focus more on the more serious cases.
It is, but it is going to be bringing a few folks into the system that weren't there before. So that 20% that Kathy talked about that's in court, we're probably going to have an increase, but here's why. Because those cases that the department would let go, those very serious cases, and here's where they could be. They could be domestic violence batterers that directly abusing their children, even sexually abusing their children, but the battered parent was protecting. Then in the past, DHHR wouldn't even open a case on them because they had a protective parent. So the termination of that batterer's rights never would have come to fruition in the old system. So they're going to bring those cases in. And that might increase the number of people that are going to court. But that's a good thing, because we were finding that prior to this change that those parents were petitioning the court themselves when the department wouldn't, or were trying to work through family court when the department wouldn't. I mean, we literally had batterers who were sexually abusing department would not file a case on.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So let's see if anybody else has any other questions or comments.
Yes, we do have a question from our guest in Denver, Colorado. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, I was looking through the materials that you had sent out in advance, and it looks to me as if one of the changes you were able to make is that you're able to file against non-biological parents who are abusive to a child in the household. Is that correct?
Yes. You can, in West Virginia, you can.
So, as a matter of fact,
in West Virginia, parental rights can be terminated of a parent who the abuse of the child was not related. They just lived in the house.
Wow.
So in other words, one of my cases early on was a little boy that was killed, and the parental rights of the parent, who wasn't even the parent of this child, were terminated. Because the court found that if you're living in the household and you make no effort whatsoever to protect a child, this little boy that died had been tortured for a long time. The coroner had a long, hard time deciding what was actually the cause of death. But and said, you know, if you couldn't have intervened under those circumstances, then your children aren't safe with you either. So West Virginia does have a provision for intervention when whether or not the other child that has been injured or is at risk is the biological child of the other person or not. It matters not. What matters is whether or not they live in the household and we're in a position to have done something.
Wow, that is a big difference.
So yeah, it's pretty sweeping. Federal law requires now intervention by the Department of Human Services in certain circumstances. They call them aggravated circumstances, different circumstances. But West Virginia took what was required by the feds and added a few extras, including now this last legislative session that Joyce and I were talking about, if the batterer has maliciously wounded or even killed the other parent of the child, then that's mandatory intervention by the department.
So we have just a few more minutes. I'm wondering if we can squeeze in another question or comment. Do we have any others, Stephanie?
At this time, there are no additional questions in the queue.
Okay, great. Okay, so Kathy or Joyce, do you have any last comments before I kind of wrap us up?
No, I think we're ready to go for the next call.
Okay. Joyce?
No further comments from me, Olga.
Okay. So what I heard today is really powerful. And I think that, like, as we kind of as we move forward in our communities to try to make changes and to collaborate more between domestic violence and child welfare and the court system, we can go to the table and we can and lots of communities have followed a similar process to what West Virginia has. The piece that I haven't seen any place else is the changes in the law. The changes in the law, the case law, and having such a, like, everyone involved at the very top, the people who could bring them to the table. But then, because in some communities, it's that combination that you guys have of bringing the people to the table and then coming up with a solution, which is changing the system. Like in a lot of communities, they've brought people to the table and they've done good, really good collaboration, but the system still has this kind of failure to protect and is looking for, you know, how this parent is not protecting this child and not looking at that non-offending parent as a victim. And so what we have, thanks to West Virginia, is something to bring to the people at the table to look at to see, is this something that we want to implement in our communities? And also to kind of watch and see how things go in West Virginia. I mean, we get to kind of, to use a golf term, we get to kind of go to school on you. We get to, you know, to watch. So those of you who know golf, you know, when we get to learn from your experience and see how then we might be able to take what you've done to our communities and try to implement it and maybe make different mistakes, maybe make the same mistakes, but it's really, really exciting to see what you've done.
And thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I've talked to you guys, and I'm listening really carefully in this call, and I still don't get how you did it. other than the fact that you were really creative, and you really wanted to do something different for families. And I think that's amazing. So I'm really excited for our call on October 21st, and I just want to remind everyone that is next Tuesday, right? Am I right on that? Next Tuesday, and it's at 2 o'clock Central Time, and that same number, same code, everything, right, Liz?
Right, and I'll send out a reminder on Monday.
Okay, cool. So with that, I guess we can let folks go.
And thank you very much for having us. This has really been an exciting day for us as well.
Great.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kathy and Olga and Joyce. And I'll look forward to connecting with you all again next week on Tuesday. And to everyone else, please, if you would, take a moment and complete the evaluation that came to you in your email reminder. And turn that back in as soon as you can. We always appreciate your feedback. It's so helpful to us to determine what our programming will be to come. So
great. Thanks a lot.
Take care, everybody.